Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
On the last episode of Guilt.
Okay, but this is where it gets really, really interesting. Somewhere between here and here, they ran into a woman, that woman I was telling you about, the redhead woman they described, who their exact words were, a big redhead woman.
He's looking at me, you know, and I thought, he's not pulling my leg.
Yeah.
And I'm like, must be a sheep, bro. And he's like, no, it's a body. And I'm like, nah, must be a sheep. He said, no, I can see the skull. He said, it'll be a sheep skull. He said, no, it's not, bro. And I'm like, fuck, he's serious. So I'll go and have a look. Oh, fuck, he's right. It's a body. It's a person. It's not a sheep.
And he would just search for years, walking all the tracks, going off the tracks. It could just consume them.
I was the last one that probably ever saw them alive, and I've never told anybody.
They've obviously been digging, and I've just pulled a bone out. There's a piece of bone right here.
From Brevity Studios, I'm Ryan Wolfe, and this is Guilt. I said, this season of the podcast was effectively going to be broken into two parts. In the first 7 episodes, or part 1, we've explored the known elements of this case and the trial, spoken to some of the key witnesses, and visited the locations involved. Now, we're going to begin the final series of episodes that, through explosive new witnesses, are going to completely rewrite the history of this case. Forget everything you've ever read in any book, seen in any documentary or court transcript, because that's all about to change. This is part 2 of season 3 of Guilt. The Hunt. If you'll recall, when we started the very first episode of this season of Guilt, I was standing on a beach, which is one of the most beautiful beaches anywhere you'll see. It's typical New Zealand, golden sand, gentle slope, beautiful. Anyway, I was standing on this beach because I'm waiting, because one of my brand new witnesses is in a police interview right now. So yeah, welcome back. As of this episode, we are now caught back up with where I was in the opening segment of episode 1, standing on the beautiful Whangamata Beach. In the months since that day, my investigation has progressed further than I could have ever imagined. And soon enough, you'll all hear the truth about what really happened to Heidi and her barn. Right now, as I record this, it's all unfolding live. But let's jump back a few days from this beach I'm standing on to a phone call that changed everything.
I was just at home in my office, and as I do throughout the day, I make calls to different people, and I was about to start work on something else, and there was a name there, and I just thought, maybe I'll give him a call now and just get that out of the way. And within a minute of that call, my hairs were standing up on end. Just quite simply one of the, if not the most important piece of witness evidence in any case I've looked at. I immediately said, hey mate, I need to come meet you right now. I cannot delay. I'm not even going to make this tomorrow. Anything could happen. So I'm in my car and I'm driving.
Oh yeah, hi, it's Barry here.
Hey Barry, how are you? Thanks for calling me back.
Yeah.
Hey, my name's Ryan Wolf. I have a podcast investigating unsolved New Zealand crimes.
Yep.
And I've got a case at the moment that I'm working on, trying to locate the body of Heidi Parkinen.
Yep.
So just to be clear, so was it your son Darren that saw?
That's right. Yep.
He saw the car.
I was the last one that probably ever saw them alive, and I've never told anybody.
Can I come over and meet with you?
Yep.
Okay. How about should I shoot over this afternoon?
Yep. Shoot over any time.
Must be just down here somewhere. I'm back in the Coromandel. However, this time, I'm not in Thames. I'm driving back into the beautiful beach town of Whangamata, where, if you'll recall, we started this season of the podcast. I'm pulling off into a street, looking for the address of a man who only a few hours ago told me that he was the last person to see Heidi and her barn alive. And what he's about to tell me is the first piece of a puzzle that's going to blow this case wide open. I'm going down into a bit of a random block here. There's a house on that's been relocated, just still sitting on piles, on stilts, I mean. Is this where Barry is? I don't know, is this fucking hell? As I make my way down through a paddock, a house that's been recently relocated sits on fresh piles. But it's empty, and I can't see any signs of life. Just as I'm thinking I must be in the wrong spot, I see ahead and down the hill a gap through the trees and a muddy gravel entranceway. A tiny cabin sits beyond, next to an old boat and a Toyota ute. I guess this must be the place. As I hop out of the car, I can't help but look up and see in the distance the thick forest of Parakawai and the location of the discovery of Urban Hoglund's body in 1991. The cabin door slides open and a solid, elderly man makes his way over to me. Not Barry, are you?
Oh, hiya.
Hey, how are you? Ryan.
I'm deaf as a bat.
Deaf as a bat?
Yeah.
Okay. Barry, though, eh?
Yeah, Barry. Yeah.
Shit, I had a hard time finding it. I drove up there and down there.
Yeah, well, I had a bit of other things. What are you actually...
So, have we got a spot to sit down? Here. Yeah.
Sit down and get out of the noise. I can see where the guy was buried.
Yeah.
And I still have that video in my mind every time I look up there and I see it.
Well, let's sit down and you tell me about it.
This 30-second video.
Barry is 79 today and deaf as a bat and tells me that as he gets older, memory gets a bit fuzzier. But there's one memory that's been burned in his mind for the last 34 years, as vivid as the day he saw it. We pull up a couple of chairs in the cabin, and he takes me all the way back to 1989.
I just think what you...
So there's some people that used to come out to my farm all the time, every weekend. Everything around here, it's not what you know, it's who you know. A lot of these are second and third generations of people that have lived in the district, and their parents used to work for my parents. Okay. And they come and they work for me, you know, two generations later. And these people used to come out to my farm every weekend. And in the weekend, we'd go on motorbike trips.
Yeah.
And we'd go through the bush, we'd go through the wires, we'd go fishing. We'd do a lot of things.
Well, why don't we
see, what happened was, I used to own the farm out here. I had what they call, I had a 1,000-acre sheep farm. And I had it for 8 years, but I struck it at the wrong time. The first year I bought it, I broke in 300 or 400 acres of land. I had a lot of money because we sold a valuable farm in Waihee and we bought that as a rundown farm, but as a future long-term investment. Yeah, and so what I was doing at the time, I had a piece of land up the Prakawai. It's just it was a small block on the right-hand side that went up and it was cut off by the river and an adjoining block. And it was a pain in the ass to farm. It was like only 30 acres, and like my farm was 1,000 acres, and to have three 30-acre blocks all cut off with a main highway, a river, and a piece of Maori land that ran right through it. And so the neighbour wanted to sell his farm, so I bought his farm, and I got enough money, even with all that things that were going on, to buy it. So I doubled the size. I sold 100 acres and bought 250 acres or something. And so these people came out every weekend and they'd give me a hand. We'd go motorbike riding. Oh, shit, we've gone past that place a dozen times. We used to go through the bush and round and round. And anyway, I sold that block and a woman in town bought a school teacher. And his wife used to have wanted to run a goats. And she bought 10 acres and wanted fenced up into 10 little paddocks for goat farming. So I gave them a price. I said, oh, I could do it quite cheap for you, you know, seeing you bought the place and stuff. And I was fencing then. It was late in the afternoon like now. And I don't know what time of the year it would have been. But when I first bought the farm, I couldn't make out why all this traffic would used to go up that side road at 10 o'clock every morning.
And what road?
3 o'clock in the afternoon, all the traffic would come down the road. And of course, I didn't know, I hadn't been in town long enough to find out. And then I found out there were the school teachers' wives, the lawyers' wives, a whole lot were growing bloody dope. And so that was a general pattern. So I got to know who the cars were. But anyway, I was fencing away this day, and it was late in the day, about this time of the day, 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and this car came up, and it was unusual. Nobody went up that road that time of the night, because the valleys are so deep, they go dark. Like the sun goes out of the valleys at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I saw this car, it would have been doing not even 20 kilometres an hour. And it came up, and I just saw it, and it was a white car, that's all I can remember. Quite a small, it wasn't a big car, it was only a white one. And this guy would have been here to there from me, 2 metres. The window was wound down. First thing I noticed was he was a Maori guy. He looked, reminded me straight away of Billy T. James. Similar sort of face and that, but this guy had a straight deadpan expressionless face. And sitting beside him was this beautiful blonde. And she was staring straight up the road, but I didn't see him. see her. She was looking straight ahead. He looked at me, and Coughlin was in the back seat, and the window was wound down on his side behind the drivers as well, and he was sitting like across the seat like this.
Like casual.
Just casually lying across the back seat. And I watched him, had proper eye contact with him.
With Urban.
And it just as he was driving by like that. And I watched him. And I, what the fuck are those guys doing going up this time of the day? It didn't look right. And I didn't do anything about it at all, but at the time, my missus had just left me. And I was sort of down in the dump, and I didn't really want to be involved with anything. And so I just sort of left it.
Pardon? So when you saw them driving up,
yeah,
what was the demeanour? Like, what did they...
Well, he was just... It was the most expressionless face I'd seen. It was...
Did the driver look at you?
He was looking straight at my face.
When you said Billy
and that was the same car that I saw, was the same car that my son saw. It's the same car that Millen saw at a Pottery Beach. When it was the same vehicle.
When you said Billy T. James, what's the thing of his face? Well,
it was just the colour of his skin, the dimensions of his face. He sort of had quite big teeth. Yeah, but his face is down like that in the corners. It wasn't like a smiley face.
So he turned and looked at
you? Yeah, I was looking straight at him. He was looking at me. I saw it for probably 30 seconds, the whole thing.
And when they drove away, what did you think?
What in the hell are they doing going up here this time of the day?
How late did you stay fencing that day?
Well, I was there for half an hour or an hour. I would have worked until just before dark.
So you never saw them come back?
Never saw them come back out.
Let me pause for a moment to remind you that according to police, the last time Heidi Parkinen and Urban Hoglan were ever seen alive was Friday the 7th of April, when they had their hair cut in Thames. And according to the police's theory of the events that took place, Heidi Parkinen and Urban Hoglan were never in Whangamata. They were met by David Tamahedi while tramping up the Tararu track at the end of Tararu Creek Road, 73 kilometres away. And the road that Barry was fencing on the day he saw the white car drive past with Heidi and Urban and the mystery driver? Have you guessed this part? It's Parakawai Quarry Road. This is the remote road that accesses the thick bush where Urban Hoglan's body would be discovered by Darren Old and Jamie Corbin in 1991. But how could this be? Like I said, this is only the beginning. So much more is yet to come. But I can assure you that everything that's ever been believed is about to change.
Yeah.
All I did was I saw them go up. I knew it was unusual.
So in the back, Urban, he was just chilling out.
He was just chilling out. He had long hair right down to the ear. He was just sitting there like this, across the back seat. And I looked straight at him. And both of them were looking at me, but she wasn't. She was looking straight ahead.
So we'd have to think, at that point, they're just... calm, like they're just going for a drive or something.
That's why I dismissed it.
This might sound silly, but what percentage would you say you thought that was Heidi and Urban in that car that day? How positive are you that was them?
Oh, that was them, definitely. No two ways about it. She was so blonde. There was nobody in Whangamata that looked like her. She was really attractive looking person, what I could see. And that was a bit that struck me, was how such a neat blonde could be in that car with a guy that was so dead the opposite. It was just his what I call deadpan face. Just no expression on his face whatsoever.
Yeah.
It just, his eyes were not, you could see his eyes, they were, you know, they were quite, to me, they looked They weren't overly large, but they looked straight at me. His teeth, he had a full set of teeth, because I saw those quite clearly. So he must have had his lips opened a bit, but it was down like that. And that was so strange.
Yeah.
It was just the contrast between the people. You know, what in the hell's going on here?
It's massive, Barry.
It was only like 30 seconds, but that's lived with me all my life. But I'm at peace with it, eh? It doesn't worry me. I always, every time I go up there and I look up there, I see that video in my mind so clear, even today. Not as much as what it was, say, 10 years ago, but I can still visualise it.
Yeah.
That car just going like that.
And how fast was it driving?
Oh, like I said, hardly even walking pace. It was so slow. That's a bit that got me, was, what are they doing? Driving so slow. And it was the people in the car, it was not a match, you know what I mean? It was so unusual. I don't know what it is. I pick on things like that, eh? I seem to have quite a memory for things like that. So that's what one guy kept coming and he said, fuck, you've got some memory. Like, I can tell you what I did. I can tell you exactly what I did 30 years ago.
When you saw Urban in the back of the car, you know, when you saw Urban in the back of the car, he looked fine, like not hurt or anything?
No. He was just sitting there. Yeah, he just relaxed like this across the back seat, lying there like this sort of thing. I was that close. You could. What happened is my boundary, when they put the road in, they put it, my survey pegs were the actual water table of the bloody road. But on the other side, they had a road reserve of 20 metres wide. Like, the road should have been shifted over, you know, 5 or 6 metres, and there was no road frontage. My boundary fence was right on the edge of the metal road.
Yeah.
Shit, it's bloody hell.
Would we be able to, you know, you're busy now, but...
No, I'm not busy,
I'd love to go see with a spot where you said you saw them. How long would it take us to get there from here?
10 minutes.
Should we go for a drive?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Yep.
The implications of this sighting and what it could potentially mean are massive. If Barry was just some random guy off the street, I'd be skeptical. But he isn't. Barry owned 1,000 acres of land in the Paraquai area in 1989. We haven't got into it in detail yet, but it was in fact Barry's son, Darren Lindsay, that reported seeing the white Subaru station wagon parked 100 metres from where Urban's body would eventually be found. So the big question about Barry's sighting: when? I need some way to corroborate this story. It's been 34 years since Heidi and Urban's murders. Perhaps Barry could be recalling a sighting from years later, and over time, he's made it fit. Well, Barry has the answer. He doesn't know the exact date, but he knows who will.
But I didn't ring a bell. It wasn't until the woman that I was fencing for, Waverley Vaughan, who still lives in Wangamata here, said, oh, I've got a diary. And when I looked up the diary and we had the big meeting up here, you were fencing on the roadside.
So she knows the date?
So she would have the date.
Fucking hell.
Good morning.
Hey, is this Waverley?
It is.
How are you today?
I'm good, thank you, Ryan.
Thank you very much for for getting back to me. And
yes.
I don't know, did you own property up there at the time in that vicinity?
Yes, we had a lifestyle block on that little road that went up into the bush.
Yeah.
That where Urban Hoglund's body was found, the Parakawai. Mm. He walked Parakawai Road, yes.
So how far, yes. So if you turn off of the main State Highway 25, mm. how far down that road are you?
We were the one right on the corner with the yep. corner between the main road corner.
Okay, that's right. So what happened? Barry says that he was out there fencing and
he did do some fencing for me. That's quite true. We didn't live out there at the time. We bought that block as a piece of bare land, and I had some dairy goats and I needed some fences to keep them in. And yes, I knew Barry was a good fencer. I'd known Barry for some time because we've lived in Wangamata for many years. And yes, that would be true. He would have been, I know he did fencing for me. What year was this?
Yes, so this was 1989.
89, oh yeah, yeah.
So you owned that property at that time?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, we hadn't owned it for very long, but as I say, we didn't live on it at the time, but I was getting fencing done.
Barry said that you used to keep diaries of work that was done for you.
Well, no, I don't actually think I did. I'm not very good at record keeping. And I don't know whether I've got any of my old records from that time now. I think I might have, you know, I would have kept all my accounts and payments and things like that.
Okay.
But I could have a look for you and see whether, even if I've got a receipt that's or an account that shows when Barry did that fencing for me.
I know it's a big ask.
Hello.
Hi, Waveney.
Yes, hi, Ryan.
Hey, how are you? Have you had a chance to have a look at that property purchase?
I have been hunted through all my paperwork, but unfortunately, when I moved house, I biffed a whole lot of old stuff out, and I think that's where it's gone, unfortunately.
So I could actually look it up, but I need to know which yes. property it was.
Yeah, that's quite the only way I've tried to find out what the rapid those rural properties were allocated a rapid number.
Okay. Test. Okay, so it is a horrible day outside, but more importantly, so I've been sent through, just following on from where we were, with Barry's sighting, which is, you know, pretty big stuff. It might, you know, it might seem small, but it's actually extremely key, placing Heidi and her barn both alive up that same road. So speaking to Waveney Vaughan, she was not able to find her property files related to when they bought that property. Now, just going back here, clearly the timing of when Barry saw that car with who he says was Heidi and her barn in it is crucial, because we're going back 34 years here. You know, who knows? He might be getting confused and he might have seen something 5 years later. You know, a similar couple. And I'm sure that there are other couples who look similar over the decades. But anyway, so I've been sent a certificate of title, which I've just bringing out here now. So a friend of mine, and thanks, you know who you are, has pulled the certificate of title for the property on Parakawai Quarry Road. It took a little bit of finding to figure out which one it was, and let's have a look here. Okay, oh, here we go. Right, so this is going back. So this certificate of title is subject to blah blah blah, 1979. Okay.
All right, so it's got, it's okay. So we can see here going back through, we've got 1997 it was transferred. 1991 it was transferred. Okay, and then coming back here, transfer to Reginald Thomas Vaughan, Deputy Headmaster, and Janet Waveney Vaughan. Okay, that's what we want to see. Housewife, you know, it was the 80s. Both of Whangamata. And the date, 28th of the 9th, 1988. It couldn't be a better timing. According to Waveney Vaughan, she says that Barry did fencing for her, and it was sometime after she bought that property. She said it would have been somewhere late 1988 after they bought the property into the beginning of 1989. And remember, the time we're looking for is the beginning of 1989, April. April is this, is when the Swedes went missing, the beginning of April. Now, this gives us, this doesn't lock down an exact date. It doesn't. Waveney said she doesn't have an exact diary anymore. She doesn't have those records. It's been that long. But what it does say is that we're looking at the right time period. Barry told me it was a big job. This fencing job took a long time. Yeah, I mean, remember we talked about that circumstantial rope and we were talking about Tamahedi's case. I feel like let's start making a new piece of circumstantial rope over here. And here's the first piece of the puzzle. All right. That's good. That's what I want to see. This is good stuff.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Let's just pull over and have a quick...
Show me, you show me where you were.
See, that's where they were up there.
Yeah.
Probably right about here. This was a metal road in those days. So the metal would have been right to here. So that's the distance I would have been away from the car. And I just looked up there and I just saw this car coming very slow. It was only a bit faster than walking pace. And it came up and the road was lower than what it is now. And I saw him. He would have been probably there away from me.
So like sort of here?
From there to there. I saw him. She was there. She was looking straight up that way. He was looking straight at me. And he was in the back seat, right over on the other side, looking this way. His window was open as well, on this side. And I saw him. And, you know, there was nothing. It was just, I just saw him sitting relaxed onto the back seat. And I just watched him. what in the hell? Because there was nothing here. That was all farm paddock at the time. There were no trees. And like that was all grazing paddock. And I just watched them.
Yeah.
And that's all I saw.
And around here, none of these houses?
There was
houses?
No houses here. There was nothing here. It was just open farmland.
Wonder why.
So this was all grass, because I owned all this and it was all grazing paddock.
Yeah.
And so this is where I was standing, this is where I was fencing, that would be the boundary. I had netting on the fence, so that would be it. The water table was right here, the road was about there. Yeah.
I can't overstate how important the sighting is in this case. Remember that according to police, no one ever saw Heidi in her barn after that haircut in Thames. There is little doubt that whoever this person was driving the vehicle must be in some way connected to their disappearance. This is without doubt the most important sighting in the history of this case. Barry said he looked this man in the eyes from a distance of about 2 meters. We'll get into possible identification at a later point, but he described him as looking like Billy T. James. Billy T. James was arguably New Zealand's most celebrated comedian, so I hate to use him as a point of reference, but that's what we have. In short, Billy T. was a Māori man of a somewhat darker complexion who was well known for having a bushy moustache. So would he look similar to David Tamahiti? Without a doubt.
Who knows?
Shit, that's clear water down there, eh?
Yeah, well, it'll get clearer.
It's a bit murky with the rain.
Yeah. This is known as the car park. So you're right on the car park here. They would have been parked in here. Now look at that.
Yeah.
It was very similar back then. It wasn't much different. Nothing's really changed here over 30 years except the trees have got a bit bigger.
Oh, so those trees would have still been here, but this bit
yeah.
is just...
Oh, this is the scrubby shit that's come up.
Well, it's interesting.
If it was Heidi and her barn Barry saw in the car that day, and I believe it was, then why would they be here? Why would Urban be relaxed in the back seat while someone else drove the car? Up here, in this remote place. There are a few possibilities. But after some basic research of the area, there was one that immediately stood out to me. Parakawai Quarry Road, where Barry saw the Swedes, terminates after only a few kilometres. And at this spot, is a small car park, a swimming hole, and a campsite. And an easy walking trail leads to a beautiful waterfall. It's a stunning location. The river sweeps around a corner, the sound echoing off the cliffs and the forest. I guess you'd call it a hidden gem. While people do come here, it's not well known to travellers, particularly in the days before the internet. But of course, to locals, those that knew the area well, this would certainly be a spot you might recommend. And interestingly, Barry Lindsay's wife at the time made a statement to police that she saw a white Subaru station wagon parked in this car park sometime in early April of 1989.
We should come up.
Well, it's interesting too, because I wonder if his mum was down here. You have to be right here to see the cars,
yep.
You know, so it's not like you're not like you're looking from 500 metres away. She must, what, you know.
No, they would have driven up here and parked in here.
Yeah.
Yeah, they drove up here.
Yeah, I mean his mum.
Yeah, you know, his mum.
Yeah. What would she be doing up here?
Going for a walk.
Yeah.
Who knows?
But yeah, what I mean is, you know, it's not like she drove past and, oh, like
no,
she
no.
literally came right
she
up here.
She literally pulled up in here and turned around and saw the vehicles. They either drove off or went for a walk or whatever.
I'd have to, yeah.
There's the quarries over there, we'll go.
Yeah. You think, you know, like, could they have been lured down here by David or whoever it is?
Yep.
And then they do this, they go see the waterfall, and then they're driving on the way back, and for whatever reason he tells them to go up there.
Yeah, remember David has a thing about talking to tourists and showing them around.
Yeah, he does.
He's always had that, and that's a fact. He's always been like that. So there's a very good chance that he's met them and befriended them, and then everything's happened from there. Mm. And he sort of steered the whole thing with a motive.
Alan is exactly right. Remember that it's a fact that on April 11th, 1989, the day after he says he stole the car from Tararoo Creek Road, Tamahedi took three tourists for a tour of the Coromandel in Heidi and Urban's Subaru. One of those tourists, Hakan Bokul, recalled how astounded he was by Tamahedi's knowledge of the Coromandel and its Māori history.
Oh, did you want to go over this way?
Yeah, let's have a quick look. So that's where they would have been right here.
Yeah.
And they said that they loved camping in New Zealand next to fleas. Did you read that? They used to tell their friends at home they used to find a place by a stream. And make sense.
Yeah, it's a beautiful spot.
Oh, it is, yeah. You see the old fort set there?
Yeah.
It's actually washed away in the middle. It's been like that when I used to come here. It's always been like that. But hey, they could have been parked there, you just don't know.
Oh, I would say, yeah.
That's what a witness is saying.
Yeah, exactly. I know it's quite eerie when you're here and you think...
Somebody's walked up there, see the little shit's broken?
Mm.
Oh, no.
Just come
it's
down
fallen down, yeah, you can see.
Mm. I mean, like you said, this sort of staying in this spot fits their sort of MO of what they like.
Alan and I wander across the small gravel car park and follow the path over a bridge crossing the Otahu River, where it opens into a small grass area hidden in the trees. It's a dead end due to a huge wall of loose rock from an abandoned quarry. Some beer bottles sit next to an old fire. I can't help but have a very eerie feeling here. It's very remote. Down the end of this road, in the thick bush, with cliffs on all sides. It may be beautiful, but I wouldn't want to camp here on my own throughout the night. I'll share a few photos of this spot on my Instagram. Alan and I jump back in the ute and make our way the few kilometres back down Parakawai Quarry Road. As we drive, I look up at the walls of this dark valley and wonder what secrets it holds. What is this stone scene? On our left, we pass the site we thought police had found human bones in episode 1. Today, the water just meanders around the bend, as it has done for thousands of years. Then another minute on the gravel road turns sharply left, then down into a ford of water. It's the forest road that leads up to the location of Urban's discovery, a place I now know all too well. Then we slow at the site Barry says he saw Heidi and Urban driving slowly with the man with the expressionless face. The fence Barry built still stands today. He showed me the exact twist in the wire he made at the moment they drove past that afternoon, possibly to never return. Today, just a small but strangely significant artifact that connects the past to the present. There's another reason we came to Parakawai today, other than to visit the waterfall. And this is a campground in the Wentworth Valley, directly over the ridge from Parakawai. And as the crow flies, only 900 meters up the hill, to where Urban's body would be discovered. And Wentworth Valley Campground has significance other than its close proximity. It's here that three witnesses, Lynn Jones, David Thorpe, and David Reed, saw David Tamahedi while mountain biking between the 3rd and 5th of April, only days before Heidi and Urban would eventually disappear. Here is an extract of David Reed's testimony in Tamahedi's trial that I've paraphrased for clarity. During Easter of last year, I was visited by my friends David Thorpe and Lynn Jones. I planned a mountain bike excursion up Wentworth Valley. I think from memory this was on the Monday following Easter weekend, April 3rd. We rode as far as the waterfall because it gets a little bit rough after that. We stopped there and had a bit of lunch. We met a bloke coming out of the bush. He had come from further up the track down to where we were from the Hikataya end. Initially, he was a bit startled when he saw us, but after a few moments, he sort of relaxed a bit. I recognised the man I saw that day as the man sitting in the court, David Tamahedi. I remember he had quite a heavy pair of work boots and quite a large sheath knife at his side. He had a fairly large pack that he carried high up on his back. He took that off and talked to us for about 20 minutes. We were just talking about pleasantries, where he'd been, weather and stuff like that. He said he'd been in the bush for quite a while, months, and that he was able to survive eating plant life, edible vegetation from the bush. I noticed he had quite piercing eyes. He seemed fairly familiar with the area and had some quite detailed maps we were looking at. After that, he headed off back down the track towards Wentworth Campground. We ran into him again down there. He didn't have his pack. He said he'd hidden it in the trees to stop people vandalising it, and that he was heading into Wangamata to get supplies. And this extract I've paraphrased from David Tamahedi's own testimony when he took the stand. On Sunday, April 2nd, I crossed over from Wires Camp into the Wentworth Valley. I ran into Mr. Thorpe and Mrs. Jones bike riding or something like that, about 4 or 5 kilometres up the bush near Wentworth Falls. There's no denying that Tamahedi was at the Wentworth campground between April 3rd and 5th. Tamahedi claims he stayed on the 2nd and left on the 3rd, but the mountain bikers placed the date somewhere between the 3rd and the 5th. Tamahedi was not seen again by anyone until he checked into the Sunkissed Lodge on April 10th, after he says he stole the car. We need to bear in mind that Tamahedi also didn't necessarily want to be seen. He had been on the run for 2 years after fleeing bail on the rape charge. At the time of the investigation, police had zero interest in any possible sightings of Tamahedi or the Swedes in the Whangamata area, which includes Parakawai and the Wentworth Valley. According to their theory, everything took place 73 kilometres away at Crosby's Clearing, a difficult 5-hour tramp from the Tararu Creek Road end in Thames. The proximity of Barry's sighting, Tamahedi's last known position in Wentworth Valley, and the location of the discovery of Urban's body is 2.5 kilometres. If we were to assume it was Tamahedi that Barry saw driving the car that day, then clearly he must have met them somewhere. But where? Well, there's one place that jumps to the top of that list. The Wentworth Valley Campground.
Right, I'll give you a wee look around this campground. So, got some kids playing down there. So it's actually a really, really nice little spot. It's got heaps of different areas. See over here. Nice wee open area through here. I guess they must open this up in summer, but very cool. You can imagine this packed out in summer. I think Manuka trees all over the place. Really cool, and it heads right back up through there. You got your barbecue facilities, your toilet, showers, and that kind of jazz. Yeah, very nice. Wentworth Valley Campground. It's run by Doc. Pretty cheap, 15.
New Zealand is a small place. Eerily, this audio is from an overnight camping trip to the Wentworth Valley Campground me and my fiancé took in October of 2021. It also holds a bit of a special meaning to me, as our hike to the waterfall was the last adventure of my then 11-year-old German Shepherd Semper before he passed. But the point is that it's an absolutely fantastic campground, with large areas of grass, surrounded by forest, a river, and the Wentworth waterfall. It's exactly the kind of spot a couple touring New Zealand could decide to spend the night. Could they have met Tamahiri here and been persuaded to take a tour of the immediate area, perhaps to the Parakawai waterfall on the other side of the valley? I want to go back and take another look at the Wentworth area. And on the way there, we happen to see a farmer working on his tractor. So we pull over to have a chat.
Jump out with that just yet. Just going to have a talk to him and see if he'll talk to you. All right. We've got him bailed up now.
The community in this area is small, and it seems everyone has some connection to this case. The farmer's name is John Shearer, and he's been a landowner in this area for decades. And in 1989, he was very familiar with the location Urban's body was discovered.
And they just came across the body. But the funny thing is, supposedly a human body does smell, and I was up there every second day because I had cattle there. I leased that for about 12 years or something, and I never smelled anything. And it was so close to the fence, the track, just at that place where the fence comes through. And there's grass there, and then I don't know if they have puri trees. Are there big puri trees there? Massive big puri trees. Anyway, that's where, looked like he dragged it to it, because the arms were back like this. Mm. So he just dragged him back and just left there. And as I say, that's not far from the actual track. And you'd have thought that I would sort of go to the top, turn around, come down, but I had, there was some fences still there.
Yeah.
And I doubt whether there's any fences there, much there now, up in the actual block. So constantly I'd go up there and the gate would have been run over. There'd have a padlock on the gate, and whoever wanted to get in or out of there would just drive over the gate. Pipe gate was mangled quite a bit. There wasn't meant to be anybody up there. I was leasing it off New Zealand. I don't know who they are. It could have been who had that then, New Zealand Forest Service or something or other. It was this whole piece, the Tairua State Forest. Either the chain would be cut or whatever. There's always a padlock on the gate. And supposedly what has happened is that... and what was happening is my rising three-year-old cattle were just going missing. And I found out from Barry Lindsay later. I said, well, is there anybody go up that road that, like, looks a bit suspicious? He said, well, I see a car going up there with a horse float. Well, they were just going up with the horse float and winching, shooting the animal and winching it straight in and taking off. And I lost about 20 head of cattle. They were just going through the gate and leaving it open, and that's how they were able to get in there, because it had a sign to say that it was a forestry road, and that, what are they, green or something or other, just they're not yellow like AA signs, but the Swiss couple went up there. Just saw the gate open and drove almost to the top. Where they would have stopped was there was a rock there with a hole in it, like a little, quite a big rock. And just further up were these, I don't know if they were puri or, I think they were just huge puri trees. And there was just a green, like grassy sort of a place where it wasn't planted in trees. And that's supposedly where they found him. I don't know how they actually killed him, crept up behind him and whacked him on the head or something, I don't know. But they had their camp in this little green grass on that side of the fence, and he was pulled back through the fence, and he was underneath the tree or something, just back off so that couldn't see him, but didn't try to disguise him more.
So is that what you thought, that they had actually gone up there themselves to camp, and you reckon someone stumbled across them when they were there?
Oh, totally. Totally. They went up there, here's a road, we're Swiss people are very outdoorsy kind of people. They just like roughing it and whatever, and just thought, we'll just head off up here. And the gate was down or open or whatever, which annoyed me immensely, because I had to go up every other day just to put the gate back up. And I had a diary. It was lucky I had a diary, because the police grilled me something terrible for days. And they were just saying that I'd done it, because I was the person who had access up there, so I'd done it, And it's just the only thing that saved me, that I've kept a diary. And I said, well, there you are. Read the diary.
Do you still have that diary?
I suppose I still have it somewhere, yeah.
Because the whole thing about them potentially camping there, and if that were true, that's not something that's... Have you ever heard that before? That would be new.
Is that new? Well, it was common for us.
Oh, so people would commonly park up there?
No. It was like... whatever his name was camping up here in the Wentworth.
Tamahiri.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was in the Wentworth.
Mm.
Well, he was camping there, and people would go up, to look at the waterfall and whatever, and leave their cars, and they'd come back and things would be missing. He'd milk the tank or they'd run into town. Anything that was in the car were going missing, and it was going missing for ages. Now, the Wentworth River goes there, and there's the camp, and then a little bit further up, there's quite a big green grassy place. Well, he had his tent, everything there. Well, they found that 2 years later. They found that camp with everything in it that he'd flogged. 2 years later, the tent and everything was still there. And it was only then that they realised that it had all started up here. And the locals, they'd told the police, they'd everything, they just wouldn't listen. But the people, Wangatah people that used to like going up there and swimming in the swimming hole and whatever, had noticed,
yep,
and said that he was up there. They said that he was, he had a camp across the stream. Yeah. And the police wouldn't, they just never, just didn't even bother, just go away. It's all happened in Thames, it's not, And it wasn't until they found his body that it actually came back. That was 2 years later.
Yeah.
If you come to Wangatah and you're a visitor and you're an overseas person, you go to the information and they'll say, or a question, where are all the high spots? What can we see while we're here? Oh, have you been up to Wentworth? That's the first thing they say, have you been up to Wentworth? So they would have gone up to Wentworth. Possibly he could have met them there and gone. That's the only other way. That's back the front to your thinking of. But the other thing is, they also say, well, have you been up to the swimming hole in the Parakawai?
John said something that you are going to get very familiar with over the remaining episodes of this podcast. Police wouldn't listen. During the investigation, Whangamata locals repeatedly told police that they should be looking in the Wentworth area because it was well known that David Tamahedi had one of his secret camps hidden in the bush near the campground. And sure enough, when the body was eventually discovered, police would search the area and find the secret camp. Also, within that 2.5 kilometre radius of the body's location and Barry's sighting. In 1989, Heidi Parkinen and Urban Hoglund spent 5 amazing months travelling around New Zealand. Sadly, they were due to fly out only 2 weeks after they were last seen. As I've investigated this case, I've simply followed the evidence. But my focus has shifted. Like I said when I was on the shores of Lake Taupo some weeks ago, sometimes I feel like I'm following in their footsteps. Now it's time to take out a map and draw a huge X. Because as it was for Heidi and Urban in 1989, it is for me today. And all roads lead to Parakawai.
The weather hasn't been that good since we came to the North Island on March 17th, and right now it's raining. It's starting to get cold during the nights. We may get away with it, as we have just 4 weeks left here. Otherwise, everything has gone really well with sleeping arrangements. We haven't paid for one single night since the 29th December 1988 in Auckland. Most of the time you can find a nice little grass spot close to a small river. The tent feels like home now. Urban.
Guilt is a Brevity Studios production, written, produced and narrated by me, Ryan Wolfe. All opinions expressed in this podcast are exactly that, opinions, and are not a statement of fact by the podcast itself. All persons named are presumed innocent unless proven otherwise in a court of law. Voice acting in this episode, Joachim Berg as Urban. If you have any information related to the murders of Heidi and Urban, you can email us anonymously at brevitystudiosnz@gmail.com. You'll find further photos and video on my Instagram, RyanWolfNZ, and I highly recommend you join the discussion with thousands of other Guilt listeners on Facebook at the Guilt Podcast Discussion Group. Guilt is a 100% independent production. We've never received a single dollar in taxpayer funding. And you can support us to continue to make great content, plus get ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and early release by becoming a Brevity Plus subscriber on Apple or Acast Plus. You'll find the details of how to do this in the show notes of every episode. This podcast was written and edited without the use of AI.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.